Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As flyers associated with white supremacy make their way to South Dakota, some were recently found in Sioux Falls, state residents are reminded that neo-Nazi sentiments are not a thing of the past. How do we address nationalism, racism, and Nazi sympathies today? We begin with a look at history. Patrick Hicks is the author of more than 10 books, including The Collector of Names, that's a book of short stories, Adoptable, poetry book, and the World War II novel, The Commandant of Lubezetch. He's writer in residence at Augustana University. He's a South Dakota Humanities Scholar, and you can meet him next week at the South Dakota Festival of Books in Deadwood. I'll be there as well. Patrick Hicks joins us now from the SDPB studios inside the University of Sioux Falls. Patrick, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Lori. It's good to be here.
Your fascination with World War II and this particular part of global history and American history began at an early age. Tell us a little bit why it was so fascinating for you and how long you've really been studying World War II history.
Yeah, it seems an odd thing to be really intellectually curious to find out as much as I can about World War II, in particular the Third Reich and the Holocaust. But when I was young, I was watching a PBS documentary about the camps, and maybe some of your listeners have seen this black and white footage, which I now know was filmed by the British. It took place in Bergen-Belsen. It was the bodies being rolled into ditches, and that was a real awakening for me at a young age that the world was far more complicated and full of evil in a way that I hadn't realized. That was sort of a shock to my system. But beyond that, my mother's from Northern Ireland, so I would talk to my grandfather, my Irish grandfather, and he survived the Blitz on Belfast. So we would talk about that when I was growing up. So World War II, with these two intersections, it seemed more immediate to me than perhaps it did to other people.
It would be easy to sit back and say nothing like this will ever happen again. And that's one of the things that you really point out, that not only is it possible for another Holocaust, but there have been other atrocities that are worth noting as well, shall we say. Tell me a little bit about that and just how you kind of, when you talk to classrooms or community groups, what are some of the things that you remind them of have happened since World War II?
Yeah, and we have the phrase "never again" right. In German. It's "nie wieder," never again, in relationship to the Holocaust. And I grew up with that, so it was again a shock to me to find out that, you know, I'm almost 50 now, and in my lifetime there have been 5 genocides, and one of them in particular, Rwanda, that required only machetes, and within 80 days, 800,000 people were murdered. And that should give us all pause. And I remember watching that when that was unfolding in the 1990s on television. And, you know, the United States wasn't stepping in to do anything. So genocide, unfortunately, seems to be something that is a part of our global world. And who knows what's happening right now in Syria, for example. Certainly there's great suffering in North Korea as well. They have camps there, concentration camps in North Korea.
Let's talk about a little history of the Third Reich and the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany. How far back do you go to sort of see the seeds that are being planted?
Well, currently I'm teaching a course on the Great War in America. We'd call it World War I. I'm teaching this course with a colleague of mine in the history department at Augustana University. And we look at World War I because that's the furnace that really created Nazism. And in fact, a young corporal served for 4 years in the trenches of World War I, and he went on to win the Iron Cross First Class, and that young man was Adolf Hitler. And he suffered a gas attack, and it blinded him, and it hurt his throat, and he was convalescing for quite a while. So an entire generation of men came out of the trenches of World War I that, you know, they were German and Austrian, and they felt like they had been stabbed in the back, and they felt like they needed a scapegoat. And this is really the big rise of Nazism in the late 1920s, especially with the economic crash and how much economic pain was being felt in Germany at this point in time. We have Hitler who's standing up and saying, it's not our fault, it's someone else's fault, and we will band together and become a strong nation. And he offered easy answers to very complex questions.
Was there a backlash immediately to that? Were there voices that stood up and spoke out against that? Was that part of German culture? Or did you see sort of a flowing along and an agreeing?
Well, one of the interesting things about the rise of Nazism in particular is, Hitler's job after he got out of the army, this would have been in the early 1920s, his job was, he stayed in the army, one of the very few that stayed in the army, and his job was to attend political meetings and to write notes about what these people were saying. And it was his job to train speakers in anti-communist ways, and this is when he discovered that he had a gift for public speaking. And while he was attending a particular political meeting to write notes, this was for the National Socialist German Workers' Parties, which was the Nazi Party, and he was absolutely captivated by what he was hearing, and he signed up on the spot. He became member number 555. And the National Socialist German Workers' Party really started to form under him, and he quit his job and he became a full-time sort of politician with them. And one of the great ways that the Nazis did rise to power is they utilized a democracy, the Weimar Republic. So they were able to have these moments of public discourse, and even their name is kind of confusing. It's hard to pin down their politics. You have nationalists, which would appeal to the right. You have socialists, which would appeal to the left. You've got German, which would appeal to the right, and you've got workers, which would appeal to the left. So even their name is confusing. And the Nazis would often say contradictory things depending on who they were in front of. So they really utilized the element of free speech in a democracy, and they then curtailed free speech and ultimately freedoms from others from their minor wins in elections.
Okay, so when does it switch from utilizing free speech to curtailing free speech?
Right. Hitler was a part of something called the Munich Putsch. That's sort of a German word which doesn't have a very clean English translation. I guess revolution might be a good way to talk about the putsch. But this was in 1923, and Hitler and the Nazis, they rose up in Munich with this ridiculous idea that they would then gather all the forces of Germany and they would have this glorious revolution. And that's not what happened. Hitler was imprisoned. And he was put on trial for sedition, and he became sort of a media celebrity because of this. He wrote Mein Kampf while he was in jail, and he received a lot of people, and his notoriety started to climb. Shortly after that, he and the Nazis, they had these elections in Germany in 1928, and they had a reasonable showing. In 1932, there was another election where they won less than 38% of the vote. So this was a proportional representation in government, so they would take seats in the parliament. And when they were able to get, you know, almost 38% of the Reichstag, they began to start to control and to really take away the freedoms of the other political parties.
How are they using newspapers or media outlets? What's the role of that at this time in Germany, and how is it being used to their advantage?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about how the Nazis went about campaigning is they had, the brown shirts is what we would call them, the SA, the Sturmabteilung, which was Hitler's private army, essentially. And they would, they were thugs in uniforms, essentially. And these were often men that fought in the trenches of World War One, so they were used to violence. And they would make sure that people were making the correct vote, if you know what I mean. They would parade through the streets of Berlin and intimidate especially the Jewish communities that were there. But Hitler and the Nazis were very savvy in their marketing campaigns, and Hitler was the very first politician to use an airplane for his campaign. So he could be in Bonn one day and then, a few hours later in Munich and then in Berlin for the evening. And this was just a revolutionary way to go about campaigning. painting, and it looked like he was coming out of the sky to save the German people on this new technology. The Nazis were also the first to use something that is with us today, and that's direct mailing. So they would send these very detailed, tailor-made letters to, say, farmers and to industrialists saying, this is why you need to vote for the Nazis. And again, it didn't matter if these were full of contradictory information. The Nazis intentionally held rallies in smaller halls to make the local population there feel like it was packed. And rather than have, say, a big meeting at a sports palace in Berlin, they might go to Weimar, which is a smaller town, and this would keep people talking for days. Where if they had the same sort of meeting, the same size in Berlin, it wouldn't have the same effect. And of course, Hitler was on the radio as well. His voice sounds strange to us today as Americans who speak English, and his voice sounds strange to Germans as well. And I have no way to prove this, but I sort of wonder if that gas attack had some sort of effect on his vocal cords, as he had a strange cadence of speech, which was very mesmerizing.
You've mentioned a couple times about these World War II, or I'm sorry, you know, veterans of the Great War, soldiers who had known combat, and I keep thinking that experience would turn people to say never again. And you're sort of bringing out these people who are used to violence and are driving, you know, brought back a resentment from this.
Yeah. And, in the United States, we don't, I think, really know much about the Great War of 1914, 1918. Yeah. It's a war that shaped the entirety of the 20th century. I mean, we have the communist takeover of Russia. We have the collapse of three different empires, and it really shapes everything that is to come. But we don't understand how warfare was fought in World War I in that trench system. So these men that were fighting in the trenches, the British, the French, the Americans, the Germans, they were used to the sight of death. These men had become used to seeing bodies and parts of bodies that were always around them for days, you know, months, sometimes even longer. So it was common in the trenches, for example, to see body parts if you had to shore up the trenches. And I don't mention this necessarily for shock value, but I do think that this had a profound effect on the young men who then became assumed positions of power in the 1930s and 40s. They became used to seeing piles of bodies, and I think that this certainly helped sort of fuel the Nazis' understanding of how to control populations and the idea of total warfare in general.
They're desensitized?
I think so. Yeah, and if you look at the men who ran the concentration camps, most of them served in the Great War in some capacity. So these were men that were used to the sight of death. And certainly Hitler saw a great amount of death while he was a soldier in the Great War.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is author Patrick Hicks. He's written more than 10 books and numerous essays and poems published in various publications. His World War II novel, if you haven't read it yet, is called The Commandant of Lubezetch. And you can see Patrick Hicks at the South Dakota Festival of Books in Deadwood next week. And Patrick, I'm thinking about your novel. I've, you know, really only read it once, and it still sticks with me. There's all these scenes and details that just will not let themselves go. And let's talk a little bit about bystanders and the role of everyday citizens as the Nazi Party gains steam. And we go from, you know, easy answers to complex problems, blaming somebody for what's going on, to some things that people would have found abhorrent in the beginning and then ended up sort of standing by and allowing to happen. Where do you want to begin there?
Yeah, and that's certainly how the Nazis really began to seize power, because they started to intimidate their political opponents, like the Christian Democrats, who had an equal amount of representation in the Reichstag. But Hitler, very shortly after he gained power with the Nazi Party, they built the concentration camp of Dachau in 1933. And anyone that was not supportive of Nazism would be put in Dachau. And it was this idea that you would be re-educated, if you will. So that was sort of one sort of aspect of it. You also have what I was saying, the brown shirts who are parading around Germany, and they're intimidating people. So if they're walking down the street and you don't give the Hitler salute, the Sieg Heil salute that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. You know, you might get hit with brass knuckles or something. Now, I don't in any way want to exculpate or offer some sort of forgiveness to the German population, because they certainly are involved and guilty of about what happened. But to study the rise of the Third Reich is to realize how quickly a dictatorship can take control. And by the time you might recognize it as a dictatorship, it often is too late. Mm-hmm. So this is one reason why I think it is absolutely vital to study the rise of the Third Reich, because Hitler was always talking about the Lügepresse, the don't trust the press. You know, the newspapers were lying, and he would marginalize his political opponents, and as I said, you know, throw them in concentration camps. And he offered no space for anyone that did not believe in Nazism.
Let's talk a little bit about today, and I mentioned at the beginning of our segment, you know, the idea of flyers sort of appearing, two flyers, not a whirlwind of flyers in Sioux Falls, appearing with some groups that are connected to white supremacy. How do we as Americans, as South Dakotans, sort of look at that rhetoric when it shows up in our own community?
Well, I was very pleased that it made the news. Had that happened and it didn't make the news, I would be far more worried, to be honest with you. So I think I've set the task myself that if I see these symbols of hatred, and we need to call them out for what they are, that's what they are. It's a symbol of hatred and of non-tolerance, which is masquerading itself as some sort of white pride. But it is, it's a racist ideology. We need to confront it, and I've set myself the task that if I ever see, if I was to see those flyers, I'd take them down and not walk by them. I think it's important that we take it upon ourselves to confront this head on. And this is a part of American life. You know, we had Nazi sympathizers while the war was happening. I think that there's a greater rise of sort of public display of white nationalism, which I find intriguing and worrisome. So shortly after the election of a black president.
So give me an idea then how you think the internet and the way we communicate today has changed the dynamic. Does it make it, you know, easier for something like that to take hold in a community? Does it make it harder because it's also easier to sort of rise up in opposition to hatred and violence?
Yeah, I mean, we can exist in these echo chambers of media if we want to do that. I mean, we can have our Facebook accounts and we can read only certain types of media that we want. So I think that we can ghettoize our intellectual understanding of the world, and I think that's very dangerous. I think that it's we always need to be getting out of our comfort zone, and I always appreciate it when someone sort of challenges how I think about something. And I think we need to do more of that, you know, talking to each other and with each other and not talking at each other.
Talk a little bit just at the end here. Anything else that you think is really important or really overlooked often when we talk about the rise of Nazi sympathies in Germany and particularly how it relate to us today? Any final thoughts?
I get the sense that most Americans, they think they understand what happened in the Third Reich, but the more that you study it, the more truly horrifying it becomes. We have a popular image of Nazism that appear in, you know, movies, and I think there's a general understanding of what happened, but I think that until you really dive into the rise of the Third Reich and really sort of understand what Berlin looked like in the 1930s, I think that would be really useful to look at right now.
Keep reading, keep talking, and you keep writing. Do you still, do you tire of it as a topic to teach and as a topic to write about in the future?
You would think that I would, but my imagination keeps returning to this topic. As a matter of fact, before I came to the studio, I was working on something that dealt with the Third Reich in my office. And it seems to me that every time I go into the classroom, it's always good to ask these particular questions of, you know, what does it mean to be an American? Are we a nation that is bound together by our understanding of the Constitution and of plurality, or are we a nation that is very narrowly defined by skin color and religion?
Do you feel obligated to keep, do you feel a responsibility to sort of keep doing this work in the world?
I do. Maybe that sounds kind of grand, but for whatever reason, I've got this knowledge in my head, and I do feel some sort of responsibility to talk about it and maybe to hopefully help other people think about these things that happened in history, because it's a warning of what could happen.
Patrick Hicks, the book is called The Commandant of Lubezetch. He's got 10 other books, poetry, short stories, and more. You can see him out at the South Dakota Festival of Books and on this show frequently as a frequent guest. Patrick Hicks, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.